WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Buck Henry, the screenwriter and character actor, died of a heart attack Wednesday at age 89. In the 1960s, he emerged as one of the sharpest comic voices for a new generation. He co-created the TV series Get Smart with Mel Brooks, wrote the screenplay for The Graduate, and even had a small role in that film as a hotel desk clerk. And in the 70s, when Saturday Night Live premiered on NBC, he was one of the earliest guest hosts during that all-important first season.
Thank you all very much. Now, you're probably wondering, as I am wondering, why I have been chosen to host tonight's show. After all, it's quite true, I'm not a comic. I don't sing, I don't dance. Sure, I've acted in a few films, a few television shows, I've written a few, but those aren't ordinarily the prerequisites to fronting a big show like this one. I probably wasn't their first choice.
Saturday Night Live hit the 70s like a bombshell. And before that, in 1967, The Graduate landed with just as huge an impact. Directed by Mike Nichols, it told of an aimless college graduate, played by Dustin Hoffman, stumbling into an affair with an older woman and family friend, Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Terry Gross spoke with Buck Henry in 1997. Their conversation took place at the Film Forum in Manhattan as part of a celebration of the then 30th anniversary of The Graduate. They spoke after a screening of the film, which ended with Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, barging into the wedding of Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine, whom he now loves. They run off together, making their getaway on a public bus, but after a few moments of triumph and exhilaration, they're both staring blankly into space.
Well, let's start with the end of the film. The end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop, and this like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole, it looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, I don't think we did test market it. But also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame, he's so odd looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous? You've got to
no. Nobody ever said that. And also, it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl, and they've run away from the people that they're scared of, and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
When the film came out in late 1967, it really tapped into something. There weren't really many films at all that were addressing this generational split, that were addressing the alienation that college people felt when they went home back to their parents' houses and they knew they didn't fit there anymore, and they didn't want to be there anymore, and their parents' friends were kind of scary to them. So this tapped into that at a time when Hollywood was always like several beats behind what was really happening in the world, and TV was even more beats behind that. What do you remember of what people were saying about what The Graduate meant, you know, to our culture when it was released? And what rang true to you, and what did you think was really, like, absurd?
That's a lot of questions in one. You know, it's odd because we didn't think of it as defining a time or a place and went about making it assiduously avoiding the errata of contemporary politics. And the only vague mention is when the guy who has the rooming house says, "Are you an outside agitator?" Which was more about Berkeley than it was about the time. And actually a critic, when the movie was released, took us to task for saying nothing about Vietnam, which I thought was really stupid, because it's simply not what it's about. It does come from a sensibility of some years before the time it was made, although I think the sensibility is universal. The sense of alienation that people have between teenagedom and 20-something years old, when they feel most hostile, a lot of people do, most hostile to their environment, to their parents, to their schools, to all that stuff. And since we all came out of the same time and the same sensibility, that is, Charles Webb, who wrote the book, Mike Nichols, Larry Terman, and I all came, got out of school, got out of college in the 50s, we all related to the same sources of that displeasure or enemy or whatever you want to call it.
To me, one of the greatest paradoxes of the movie is that it's about, you know, a young man who comes home and he's just so lost in his parents' environment. And so what does he do? He has an affair with his parents' mother. You know, it's the first film that really addresses the culture, you know, the generation gap. And so he's sleeping with somebody of the other generation. It's really paradoxical.
Always a good idea. To pass the time and to get to know new friends.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me.
Now, they're two very different things, sleeping,
yeah.
You know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
An uncomfortable segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
No, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot while working. He thought, well, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
Sounds of Silence. You'd think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and you know, there was never anything that could replace it. Finally, I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker. And you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called? The Strawberries?
The Lemonheads.
Lemonhead. Yeah. Well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, I mean, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. You know, ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right.
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was... it was a great, it's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, you know, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. But it was so interesting. So then we rationalized it because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long. We had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller, and this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's
wonderful. And nobody ever... I mean, there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah.
I'm going to squeeze a little question to the couple of seconds we have remaining, which is, did you identify, aside from admiring some of your mother's friends, did you identify with the Benjamin Braddock character at all?
Totally.
You did?
Oh, yeah. And so did Mike and so did Larry. We all did. I think that's what drove them toward the book and me subsequently, too.
If you identified with Dustin Hoffman's character, that kind of adrift, I don't have a future, I don't know what my future is, what was the turning point for you? Where you found writing, you found theater and movies?
Well, I always knew I wanted to do it. It was just a question of people not letting me. So when I was younger, I got out of the Army and I spent years, like 7 or 8 years, sort of batting around. I'd go on tour with a show. I'd write things that nobody would buy. And I did all that stuff that actors do. And then finally I started working in television and it all became a clearer path. I was never, I'm very lucky. I've never been out of work since I started working. But the number of years before that were very edgy.
Buck Henry, thank you so much for coming. It's wonderful
Thanks.
For you to be here.
Thank you, Terry.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. He died Wednesday at age 89.